Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
This is Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
It's good to be with you. Now, the Arab-Israeli conflict is one of the most complex and divisive issues in the modern world. There have been many people of goodwill, with good minds, who've turned their attention to this struggle to search for a solution. But the intractability of the situation, the strength of feeling on both sides, becomes very clear very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the complexity of this situation is proverbial. It's up there with, you know, when you say something's not rocket science or brain surgery. Yep. It's just the example we use of something really difficult. And similarly, peace in the Middle East is the example we use of something that just seems impossible. We are well aware that tension runs high on this issue, not just for Israelis and for Palestinians, but for lots of people around the world who line up politically or culturally on one side or the other. This is a minefield. But today on Life and Faith, we speak with someone who lives right in the middle of this situation. She gives us a deeply personal and human perspective on what it's like to live under occupation.
We'll get to that in a moment. But firstly, to give some context to what we're talking about today, we're going to hear from Gary Burge. Now, Gary Burge is an American scholar who's spent many years traveling to and writing about the Middle East and especially the Arab-Israeli conflict. His interest is in finding justice for both Palestinians and Israelis. We're going to hear from a conversation I had with him a few years ago when I suggested that surely this is an example of how religion is a force for conflict in the world.
Well, some people have wanted to interpret the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis through a religious lens. I think that's one factor in the struggle, but I don't think that's the primary factor myself. I think when people experience toxic levels of despair in a political crisis, they will reach for those things which empower them. So there are some people inside of the Jewish community who have reached for extreme forms of religion and empowerment in Judaism. There are those also inside of Islam who have reached for extreme forms of religion in their community as well. So you find that people reaching for empowering sort of instruments, you might say, inside of the conflict. But the conflict is actually much more complicated than that. It is a conflict of political power. It's a conflict of culture. I think it's actually a struggle of dispossession, of one group of people moving from Europe, in this case, into the Middle East. And already there's a population which is living there. And therefore, there's an ultimate struggle between two people to see which culture is going to win out. What's interesting, I think, about the religious question is this, is that Christians live among the Palestinians. There are over 125,000 of them living right there under the occupation, which Israel imposes on the Palestinians. And the Christians do not tend to reach for extreme forms of religion. King Hussein of Jordan once said, the Christian Arabs of the Middle East are the glue that holds this fragile project together.
Now, you've said that the conflict is driven by insecurity on the Israeli side and by displacement on the Palestinian side.
People often ask me the question, what are the fundamental things you think that are at work inside of this struggle? And I think my answer to that now, after I guess 3 decades of working on this problem, is that deep in the heart of the Israeli soul is a sense of insecurity, a justifiable insecurity, I'd say. Because they have experienced throughout history a lot of sort of persecution. Anti-Semitism is a part of the Western European legacy, climaxing in the Holocaust. Even the Jewish festivals reinforce this idea that the Pharaoh is trying to kill us in Egypt and therefore we're going to escape with Moses. So you have that sense of insecurity. And at the same time, you have among the Palestinians this remarkable sense of dislocation, that this is an ancient culture, it's a tribal culture, deeply rooted to the land. They see themselves, the metaphor for their life is an olive tree, deep roots, ancient history, it's been there forever. So they see themselves as unable to imagine existence when they're torn away from their ancient village life. I think it's symbolic when the Israelis come to some of these Palestinian areas, they actually uproot many of the olive trees. And to watch a Palestinian village observe the uprooting of their historic olive groves produces a kind of trauma that I think we in the West have difficulty understanding.
That's Gary Burge, an American scholar who's written a lot on this conflict. And you can watch the rest of that interview on the CPX website, publicchristianity.org.
Arij Massoud lives in the middle of all this, and she's impacted by it every day of her life. Arij is a Palestinian Christian, which means she's part of a population that's often forgotten in discussions of this topic. She was born in and still lives in Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, of course. She studied psychology and religious studies at Bethlehem University, and she now works at Bethlehem Bible College. She's deeply interested in issues of religion, identity, and justice. She's done a bunch of speaking tours in the US as an advocate for peace, and came to Australia as a guest of the Palestine-Israel Ecumenical Network. Her topic was, is there hope for Palestinians now or ever? She lives on one side of the wall in the West Bank. I asked her to describe the difference between life on her side of the wall compared to the other.
It's a total difference. So when you look at the map of that division that's happening between both Palestine and Israel, you would see how it's not only separating land, but it's also separating people. You would see how much it's suffocating Palestinian villages and cities and not making us able to move from one to another city or village. But yet, it's not the same for the other side. They can move freely, and it's built in a way that it's confiscating our resources, it's confiscating our land, our water, but that's all for the benefit of the other side.
Yeah, there's a huge difference economically, isn't there, in that division?
Yes, because with that division, there is, I always highlight that there's a different unequal powers of what's happening in Palestine, Israel. There's an occupier and there's an occupiee. And with that division, that means even it affects us physically, psychologically, economically, and spiritually, in every aspect of life. So for example, with that division, we have to pay taxes for our goods, and we cannot move around, even we cannot import and export easily. So that would always also increase the amount, like financial burden on us, when we don't even have the income as Israel would have. Like, we Palestinians have a lower income.
I saw a figure talking about the different level of access someone in Israel have to water compared to someone where you live.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we are not allowed to consume more than 20% of water. And if we consume over this, or we're about to exceed that, then we would not get any water. That means it'll be normal to open your tap and not find any water coming out for a day, for a week, or for a month. A normal person would consume 100 liters of water. An Israeli would consume up to 300, but we're not allowed to exceed 75 liters of water. And that's in the West Bank, but in Gaza it's even worse, much less than that.
Yes, and there's a very obvious difference if you travel between Israel and across to Bethlehem, say. It just looks a lot poorer.
It is poorer, and mainly because so many businesses, our cities has been more related on tourism, and its first income generating job was tourism, but because of the occupation, we've lost so much tourists. So many people lost their jobs and they left the country. That causing us with, and also with exporting, that we can't do anymore. So that causes us, you know, we don't have any source of good income, and we do have a high unemployment rate, like higher than 50%. So that makes it really impossible and really challenging to flourish economically and to have a better country, especially not only financially, not only that because we can't have the money, but also we can't have the resources to it. Like, for example, I admire the nature that is here, and we can't have that. We can't use the 20% of the water to have a trees, and so that's also one of the challenges. So we're controlled, and we're very restricted with any aspect of life.
One quite surprising aspect to Arij's story is that while she was born in Bethlehem, her family moved to Qatar when she was a baby. They lived a comfortable, prosperous life there, But when she was 7 years old, they moved back home. It's not the first time she's been asked, why did her family do that?
I grew up asking the same question. I didn't understand why they did that decision, but only when I grew up and I had this conversation with my family, like, why did you really do that? I understood that it was mainly my dad's decision. And when we were in Qatar, he decided we have a bigger mission to be back home in Palestine. We need to be the salt and light in our country. And that he's mostly needed as a in his presence and as a Christian back in Palestine.
Right, so he felt sort of drawn back to Palestine despite knowing that there'd be some difficulties attached to that.
Yes, and he believes that being a light is when it's most dark, mm-hmm. and that's when you shine better in your mission or in your calling. So that's mainly why we came back.
Okay, so again, back to life in Bethlehem for a Palestinian. Restriction of movement is a real factor that makes life challenging. I asked Arij what would be the situation for her if she wanted to travel from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, for instance. Now, it's not very far, it's about 10 kilometers, but it's a challenge.
First, if I want to go to Jerusalem, I need to get a permit. It's not like I want to go and I just start my car and leave. I can never drive to Jerusalem because of the wall and the checkpoints. I would have to go through the pedestrian walk. And to do that, I need to get a permit. And a permit is not like a visa with clear criteria why you get it, why you don't get it. I would need to go to a military base to request that. And you most probably won't get it. But if you do, you need to go to wait at the checkpoint. It's long lines, especially in rush hours, and that you would need to cross. And it's very humiliating to cross the checkpoint, the process of crossing the checkpoint, the humiliation of just going to a military base to request that and not granting that paper, even though it is your country.
And people are trying to get across to get to jobs, presumably, and makes it very hard.
There's a lot of Palestinians who rely on their jobs in Jerusalem. I personally worked in Jerusalem for 3 months. But during that time, and because of the long lines and of them not giving me work permit, and I now have to renew my permit each few weeks, I didn't go to my job. I missed my work for over 2 weeks, and that's over 3 months period. I couldn't do it. Like
it becomes untenable, doesn't it? Really?
Yeah. And when they asked me, "Do you like to continue working with us?" I had to give up a very good payment. Like an income generating job, because I can't be reminded also of my occupier and occupation every morning. Every start of my day, I would go stand in these lines where soldiers would decide to take their morning break in rush hours. A lot of discrimination that would happen when I'm at the checkpoint. I cannot accept that.
Now, you can't go down to the beach, Tel Aviv, presumably. Can't go to the airport either.
Not allowed at the airport, no.
No, so if you want to fly, as you did, to come here, did you have to drive to Jordan? How do you get here?
Well, I used to be able to drive to Jordan. Like my parents would do that. Like it's an hour drive. We're a very small country, so like crossing to another country is an hour. Going to the airport is like less than an hour. I could reach Lebanon in 3 hours if I'm able to drive. We're not allowed to have an airport. I'm not allowed as a Palestinian to use the Israeli airport. So my only option is to cross the borders. And even though it used to be doable and easy, now we're not even allowed to drive over the borders. Israel had its control over the borders now, having security measures and all of those matters. And since they are there, Jordanians have to prove their presence and Palestinians have to prove their presence, you know, politics. And so we need to go through three different securities just to cross the checkpoint or the borders. When it used to take us like an hour to go to Jordan, now it takes us more. It could, in high seasons, it could take us more than 7 hours. And sometimes they tell you, we don't have time for you today, come back tomorrow. So for me to make sure I'm catching up I'm catching my flight on Friday evening, I left Thursday.
Yeah, no, that's tough. Tell me about the psychological impact of those sorts of restrictions that you've been talking about.
Psychologically, what I've been noticing happening back home is that it's very tiring to always be under so much restrictions. that comes to a point that you don't see them, or they become normal and a normal part of your life, which is, I totally understand this. It's a way of mechanism, like living mechanism to just bear life. But then it's terrifying, because if we see injustices as normal, then who's going to speak up? So for example, we would be having a cup of coffee as friends, and then someone would say, oh, the view is beautiful. And I tell them, you do realize this view is a settlement. And then they like look at me like, okay, thank you for ruining the moment. I was like, oh, sorry, but that is reality.
Yeah, so the settlements are very controversial, aren't they? This is Israeli settlements built in the West Bank on territory that's considered by international law to be Palestinian.
Yeah.
I guess psychologically that has an effect too, does it?
Yes. It's not only this, it's more. They're more than a settlement. We call them colonial settlements. They're Jewish-only settlements. Palestinian houses were destroyed for them to be built on. They have their own roads, their own areas, their own security. Like, we are not even allowed to go in or live there or use the same roads they use. And they are suffocating our cities, being built so close to our villages, our cities, we can't expand. Like, my family is thinking to like relocate or just get a better house or better location. We can't find an option because of that suffocation that's happening back home.
Now, you're a Christian Palestinian. Not many Christian Palestinians left. There used to be a lot more, right? Lots of people have left.
We used to be more than 30%, but now we are less than 0.9.
Right. Gosh, that is small. How do Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians relate?
I usually get asked, actually, is that reduction in number because of Muslim persecution? And I always say no. We were 30% back then, but then the majority was not Christian. It was Muslims, and even we had Jews living in Palestine. And that was never the reason why Palestinian Christians are leaving. But then the occupation is making it hard and almost impossible for us to live there. We live normally well together, Christians and Muslims. We are neighbors, you know. We grow up, we have the same culture, we share the same land. We don't have problems being together. But then when the occupation makes it hard to live in your place in every aspect of life, and Christians, we do have a better chance in getting acceptance in other countries to leave. And that's why we've been leaving.
This is Life and Faith. Today we're hearing from Arij Massoud, who lives in the West Bank in Bethlehem. She's talking about what it's like to live in that environment. As a Palestinian Christian, she is one of a very small and often forgotten part of the population.
Now, key Christian teaching, of course, something Jesus called his followers to, is love of enemies. It's a radical teaching, easy to say, not easy to do. So I thought it was important to ask Arij what this teaching means in her context.
I had struggled trying to even understand what it means for me as a Palestinian Christian, because I do have an international definition of an enemy. But I always felt jealous of other Christians, where their worst enemy could be their neighbor or their ex-best friend.
Their annoying neighbor or yeah. Something like that, yeah.
And I wished I had that as
that
an enemy.
Kind of enemy,
you know?
A bit easier.
Then I'd have to love them and then, okay, I'll try. But then I do have an enemy, and that enemy is affecting, it's causing the persecution of myself and my people. And I learned that loving my enemy, that does have a different meaning, and that's only when I was able to live both of my identities together. Because when you're not able to live that, like loving your enemy, you can't consider yourself a Christian. So for me to love my enemy, I learned that it gives me a bigger responsibility, especially in my situation, that I have to love my enemy enough to, and out of love, to let them know and hold them responsible to their actions. Like when you love a friend or you have someone you care for, a family member, when they're doing something wrong, out of love, you let them know when they're doing something wrong and you make sure they heard you. And that's exactly the same thing for our enemy. when our enemy is persecuting us, it's not only harming us, but it's harming themselves. And out of love, I would need to stop that. I would need to put an end to this. I need to resist it. But the way to resist it with love, it's not through violence. It's through a creative resistance, which will find a way to tackle the humanity in my enemy, because my enemy is a human and I have to see him on that base. And only then I would be able to make change or create change, and my enemy would see me also as an equal human, and they cannot keep on dehumanizing me, and they would need to stop this.
So creative resistance as opposed to violent resistance. Can you give us an example of how that might work?
Well, violence resistance, as we've been seeing and we still see, it brings nothing. It only separates, and it's only doing things worse, but not bringing a solution. But creative resistance is, we can see how it ended apartheid in South Africa, civil war in South America, and Ireland as well. And that's also what we're trying to do in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to bring creative resistance, whether it's internationally or locally and even on a personal level. How can we put that in action? When I was crossing the checkpoint one day with my friend, we both had our permits, but then we didn't have our magnet cards, which is usual. We usually pass without our magnet cards. But the soldier said, "I want to see your magnet cards." We told her we don't have them. Magnet cards are biometric, have our biometric information, fingerprints, eye prints, and pictures. And we told her we don't have them. And she starts screaming like, "We're not going to pass," and told her we need to be there. We have an appointment and we do have the permit. Another soldier comes in and he's also screaming. And he starts screaming because she's screaming. And we're like trying to convince him, like, we have everything proper and you can see that and we need to pass. So he's screaming, she's screaming. I wanted to scream, but then I wondered, how can I apply creative resistance now here? Only then I noticed, I was able to take a breath, a long one. And I noticed that he has a tattoo on his arm with scrambled words that say peace, love, and humanity. And I was surprised that I was able to see that first, but then that he believed in those values so much, he has them tattooed on his arm, but yet treat us that way. So I looked at him and I, with a smile, I told him, "You have a nice tattoo." you should have seen the look at his face. He was surprised. I'm sure he wondered, what am I doing now? Why am I doing this while I have a different value myself? He looked at us and he said, "Okay, only today you can pass."
Right, okay.
But even if it might seem like a small thing, but no, it is a big deal, because Israeli soldiers cannot seem like they are uncertain or like they do change their minds. A yes is a yes and a no is a no.
Yeah, so that was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
That's a great example, actually, of trying to bring a different, diffuse a situation, bring a different point of view and call him to live up to the values that he had drawn on his arm. Yeah, that's brilliant. I'm interested to ask you, as a Christian Palestinian living in Bethlehem, in the birthplace of Jesus, what do you, as an adult, find so compelling about Jesus himself?
I always see how there is similarities between Jesus' times living in the same land and our times now. That he was also living under occupation. He had the Romans, and he knew what it feels like, and he knew what it means. And my favorite verse he said is, "Blessed are the peacemakers, they will be children of God." And he said that in the midst of his conflict, and he knew how big and what is the definition and the responsibility that comes with the request of us being peacemakers. And that always makes me smile when I read it, and it gives me hope in my heart and happiness that God has he does also remember us and know what we are going through, and mentioned us as well when he said, like, "Blessed are the peacemakers, they're children of God." But how I always wonder, how much do we take that seriously?
Now, I've heard you say that this is not a conflict about different faiths, but surely religion plays a part in the ramping up the conflict in this very troubled part of the world.
Well, the occupation is a political occupation, and injustices are violating international human law. So I'm convinced that it's not that Christians cannot live with Muslims, and Muslims cannot live with Jews, and Jews cannot live with the Christians. We've lived together in the same location, actually.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So your argument is it's really not the cause, the religious beliefs, the very different religious beliefs. It's actually just political and social, I guess.
Yes, I'm not saying that this is not, it's not having an effect on our beliefs, but it's not the real cause of it. Some people have used religion to justify occupation or to legitimize its existence, but I refuse to believe this as part of who God is, and because that would change the image of God, of a loving God and just God, and I cannot accept that that use. And it's always been use of a political agenda, which we can see clearly. But it does have its effect on us living as Palestinian Christians and Muslims and even Jews together, where my Muslim friend is exposed to mainstream media as well. And they hear the news of Christians supporting the occupation based on biblical beliefs, or Jews who do that. And then they would think that I, as a Palestinian Christian who's his neighbor, believe the same. And that would always cause tension. Like, it would always seem like I cooperate with the occupation or I accept the occupation. And it can't be true. No religion would accept persecution.
I'm sure people want me to ask you this question about the Israeli people, though, because they also live lives that are far from secure. They obviously feel a lot of pressure as well. There has been a lot of violence used. Tell us about your sense of Israeli people, too.
When living in occupation and when there's always struggles, that's the outcome of it, people not feeling secure and living in their daily lives. But then I always ask the same question, which is, who's the occupier and who's the occupiee? And who has the power over who? And who is actually still implementing the acts of injustices? And when would they stop? So we can start having peace and not keep on persecuting each other. So even when there is, you would probably hear Israelis have done the, or you might not hear that side. You would hear that Palestinians have replied with violence, and we are very much seen as terrorists in the media. But yet, if really dig deeper into what's happening, you would actually see statistic-wise and also technology-wise and occupation-wise that how unequal powers those are. For one Israeli, there's 300 Palestinian dying, and that statistics show it all. Or how many kids have been in prison, for example. There's more than 270 kids, Palestinian kids, are in prison till today, and that's unequal power. Kids even dying out of and suffocating from tear gas bombs. And three kids no older than 12 years old has been killed in Gaza recently in less than a month. So that's, you don't hear about that happening in particular, but you'd hear when there's a response back, when it's out of frustration and out of trying to make us do a difference and trying to stop the persecution that's happening in the first place. But I personally do not agree with any violence attack, but I also understand it. When someone is being, their lands are being invaded and their houses are being, but also invaded in the middle of the night and children are taken. How can you, if that happens in your home, how can you stay quiet?
Where do you find hope in this very difficult situation? So I know hope's really important to you.
It is, and it's very easy to lose it as well. And when people lose hope, that's why most of them are leaving their country. But hope is something not to be taken for granted, because we have to have it each morning. Hope is when you know what your mission is and where you're heading to and who you are and what's your community and what they mean to you and what you mean to them. So it's like waking up in the morning with knowing you're going to have a bad day, but then deciding you're either going to determine that you're going to have hope, create hope. And if you don't have it that day, you know someone else found it for you and with you, and they will share that with you.
Do you feel like you've got a bit of a purpose, therefore? A bit like your dad must have felt when he decided to take you back there as a kid and your family. Do you feel, is that what energizes you? Gives you a bit of a purpose? I'm here to have this sort of presence in this situation.
To be honest, I have a struggle in this myself. Like, I personally say sometimes, I can't still live there. Especially our generation, we're a generation with so many ambitions, but yet there's so much, there's no many opportunities to use this. So we're very stuck in a phase that I would always say, like, I just want to leave. But also, I have the other days, like, I can't leave. If I leave, then who's going to stay? And what is my mission back home? And I try to, which is connected to my hope as well, I try to remind myself each morning that my mission is to be here for my people, to be their source of hope, and to try to find the issues and the struggles in my community and how can I address them to my local community as well. So again, as I mentioned, it's not easy. It's not like I wake up in the morning every day I find hope, or it's not like I wake up in the morning every day I have the same mission. Some days I just, as a normal person, would give up and would love to just go find a better life.
But on your best days, what do you imagine might be the way forward for peace and justice in your land?
So this is a big question, because I always feel like I'm the president and I have to take a decision on how the future of those countries should be. But I, with my personal imagination...
Give it your best shot. I know many people have tried.
Yeah. Is to first stop any further injustices that are still taking place and that are still happening. And yet no force of pressure has been upon those injustices to stop. And only when we stop them, we can see how we can fix them. And those are the only steps I can think of. Because when they're fixed, then there's justice. And how can we bring justice to the table for both countries? And how can we build bridges and not keep on destroying each other that way? And how can we be implementing peace, but also just peace? Because peace alone can sometimes not be enough when there's so much has been done to destroy that.
Well, creative resistance and loving your enemy, these are big challenges, worthy tasks and challenges. We wish you all the best as you live that life. Thank you, Arish. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This has been Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore. I hope you enjoyed this conversation that Simon had with Arish Masood. Arish was here in Australia as a guest of the Palestine-Israel Ecumenical Network. You can listen to this whole conversation again on our website, publicchristianity.org. Subscribe to Life and Faith, leave us a rating or review. You know the drill. One more thing before we go, very important to say. The deadline is closing next week for our second annual Life and Faith Youth Competition. If you like Life and Faith and you're between the ages of 15 and 21, or you know someone who is and who you think could put together a pitch for an awesome podcast, we want to hear from you.
Yeah, this is a great competition. Last year, Shadi Hanna won it. He took it out with a really great idea. It ended up being an excellent podcast on the spirituality of healthcare. So we'd love to hear from more of you and your good ideas. Go to cpxyouth.org. Get in quick.
Next week.
Literally, she owns a couple of dresses, a pair of flip-flops. She lives in a house in the desert, married into this tribal group called the Afar. They're a nomadic group in the desert area of Ethiopia, the hottest inhabited place in the world. And she looks after 1.5 million of them.